John Revent with Max Crichton in his office on September 24th, 2015, rescheduled from several times, including July something. So anyways, I know you've been interviewed many times, including by Matt Miller for the State Journal back a while ago. I got the copy of that out of the paper and out of the student paper, so I don't want to repeat things that were done, but I wanted to ask you about a few different people and some things that interest me about MSU and some aspects of economics of border on labor relations economics, which isn't your field, but you knew some of the people and that sort of thing. So just for the record, if you'd tell us your name and where you were born and when. And
well, Max is my U.S. youth name. My original name is Mordechai Kleinin. I was born in Israel. I came to the United States in 52 to go to the University of Michigan in graduate program.
In economics?
Economics. Uh-huh. And I came here in 57.
What professor interested you to go to U of M in Ann Arbor?
It's a kind of a long story. It's a difficult story to explain. Uh-huh. I'm not sure it's worth it.
Okay.
Well, you know, Israel just became independent. I just got out of the army. I was in the War of Independence. It was a very difficult year.
Another time, can I ask you about that? Or?
Sure.
Okay, we'll come back to it.
You wanted to ask me what I do since I retired.
I did, but I want to make a note to myself. I'm going to ask you if we can schedule another time, because I've never read all of that story, okay?
No, so, it's rather been discussed, actually.
Okay, so I'll come back. We'll do that again.
Yeah, okay.
When were you born in Israel?
1930. Uh-huh. And then I came here in 57, and I've been here ever since, except for years I've been abroad. You know, I taught in about 10, 15 other universities around the world. So.
You taught for MSU from 57 to last year?
Yeah, to 15.
And it got written up that you were the longest serving MSU professor in history?
Yeah, I guess they researched it. I didn't research it.
Who did you beat out?
I have no idea.
Okay, I'll look it up. I didn't know if you knew.
You have to ask the president.
Yeah.
She must have told them that.
Somebody said that.
Yeah.
So a couple of questions. What interested you in the U of M economics program that you went there?
Well,
why not Wisconsin or why not Harvard?
I'm not sure that that's of interest, but at the time, Israel was just emerging, and it was a very controlled economy. Mm-hmm. So to go abroad to study that required dollars, it was foreign exchange control, it required government permission and all that. So the process was you go to the American embassy, you pick up a huge book of all the American universities, you close your eyes, you open a few pages, you take, and so my pages were, about a few of them. I took them to the Ministry of Education, and they said, of these, we only approve of two.
Oh.
University of Michigan and University of Pennsylvania.
Huh.
So I wrote to these two.
Were you on a government grant, loan, or scholarship?
It was some government assistance in a sense of...
I mean, they get to approve it. I wondered what the rationale was for approving it.
It's difficult to explain to a non-economist, but exchange control means that you have to have government approval to convert the local currency to other currencies.
Okay.
And after the Second World War, all countries were under exchange control, except the United States, maybe Canada and Switzerland.
Okay.
And so we were also under exchange control. So they approved these two universities. I wrote to them. I knew Penn was in a big city, so I was a little scared, you know, what do I know? I wanted a room in a dormitory so that when I come there, I have a place to put my head.
What dorm did you stay in?
In Michigan.
Yeah, which one, do you remember?
West Quad was my fixed one.
Because I lived in East Quad.
I don't think I lived in the East Quad, but I lived in the South Quad.
Okay. Well, I only was in East Quad.
Yeah.
But anyways, it was a few years later.
Michigan said, yeah, you can have a room in the dormitory. They neglected to say that it's always covered with snow. But Penn said, no, you can't. Penn actually said, you are an alternate for a scholarship. So I didn't understand it. Scholarship, I looked at in the dictionary and it said kind of scholastic achievement, which didn't fit. Alternate, they didn't have. So I didn't know what that was. So I went to Michigan.
How good was your English when you came?
I knew the basic structure of the language very well.
Okay.
You know, you learn it in high school. The grammatic way.
What other languages did you learn? German or?
No, you mean in high school?
Yeah.
Foreign languages.
Well, yeah, besides Hebrew.
I took Arabic.
Arabic, okay.
It was a choice between Arabic and French.
Okay.
So
you took Arabic and English.
I didn't know at the time. I'll spend my life in a Western country.
So anyways, what kind of economics did you study at U of M and under who? Did that influence what kind of economics you went into?
No, I specialized in international economics, but you don't specialize right away. You only specialize when you get to your thesis.
Right.
Under who? Under everybody. Stolper, Watkins, Ackley, Boulding.
What degrees did you get at U of M?
A master's degree and a PhD.
John Revette with Max Krinen returning. The electricity got shut off for a second. We were talking about Max's time as a student at University of Michigan and as a TA in teaching an economics macro class.
Macro and micro.
Okay.
I mean, one semester was macro, the second micro.
Uh-huh.
And because my two sections came out on top, I thought to myself, maybe I meant to be a teacher.
So that's what made you think of that?
Yeah, because I had other opportunities not teaching.
Were you thinking at the time of returning to Israel?
Yeah, at the time I was.
I mean, when the country was involved in your coming here, they must have thought you'd be coming to America and then coming back home.
That's right. At the time I thought of coming back to Israel, but things evolved differently.
So when you got your PhD, who was your major professor for that PhD?
Well, Stolper, who is very well known, and a guy called Watkins, which is not very well known.
Okay, and this was some aspect of international
economics, yeah.
Yeah.
The exact title of my dissertation was Exchange Stabilization Funds.
And that's like in 56 or 7?
Well, I graduated in 55.
Oh.
I stayed longer because I was working at Survey Research Center.
Okay.
And I had that teaching experience.
Okay. So why and how did you choose to come to Michigan State University in 57?
Well, I had a nice offer from them, and those were days, it was before Sputnik. Very difficult to get jobs.
Okay.
I had a good offer, I came.
Now, was it, who was the chair of economics, or who was the nice offer from, or was it from a dean, or from President Dean?
The economics department, I can't remember.
That's okay. So one of the people in labor industrial relations in my life was Charles Killingsworth, who was
the... Yeah, he was here. Yeah, sure. Charles was here. Walter Adams was here. I don't know who you know. Milt Taylor was here.
Okay.
Jack Stieber.
Mm-hmm.
We were very close to the Stiebers. You know, his wife died.
Yeah, I do know that. So you were close to Carolyn and Jack?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I remember coming here
to give a talk, you know, before I got the offer. And so we drove for me an album, my wife and I, to see what it's like here. I didn't know. So after everything, I go to my car, it wouldn't start. So I called up Walter. He said, I'm coming over, don't worry about a thing. We'll push your car. You know, there was a gas station at the entrance to the campus from Collingwood.
Okay.
And so we got our car here. He says, you'll have dinner with us. By the time you're done, the car will be ready.
Very nice.
And that's what happens.
So and Pauline with him?
Pauline, sure. She made the dinner.
Okay.
She remembers that. I saw her not too long ago.
Remembers it. We're neighbors.
You also live there?
Yes.
Yeah,
we bought Ralph and Lillian Smuckler's house.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So, not very far from Adams and not far from where Killingsworth
lives. Are they still alive?
Who?
Ralph and Lillian.
I was told that Ralph just died. I actually learned that from one of your former students.
I was very close to him, by the way.
What?
We worked together.
You and?
Some Ralph.
Okay, because he did international things.
He did a lot of international things.
Yeah. Right, he ended up being the dean of?
International, yeah.
Right, but I'll get back to the student in a minute. So. Yeah. Anyway, so you started working for MSU at that time. Nice offer. Those were some of the people. Was another one Lash LaRue?
Lash LaRue came about the same year that we did. Paul Strassman came. There was another labor economist at the time who came by the name of Maronix.
I don't know that person.
He left a year or two afterwards to go to California.
Okay. So, what did you teach for MSU in those years?
I taught, principles. I taught international economics, and subsequently, for many years, I taught the doctoral sequence in international economics and supervised the dissertations.
So I've heard that you felt very close to your doctoral students, that was something of great importance to you. Why was that? Was that because of how you were treated or because of...
First of all, the way I was treated in Michigan was in both by the faculty and by the grad students was incredible. And they really went out of their way to make it pleasant for me. It was amazing. You know, I was the only, it's not like now there are a million foreign students, I was the only foreign student. And I remember my prelim was the best. They gave me $125, which was a big at the
good
time.
Money.
And I bought my mother a washing machine.
In Israel?
In Israel. Uh-huh. They never had a washing machine at the time. And then they gave me a backup fellowship to do the dissertation. I didn't have to teach or do anything.
Yeah. Where in Israel did she live?
Where we lived?
Yeah.
Yeah, in a town called Rishon.
Near where?
Not far from Tel Aviv. I was treated really beyond any expectation. But no, it was being close to my grad students, that was my job. My job was to get them through the dissertation, get them jobs, and open doors for them.
The person, so we bought Smuckler's house next door to us.
Oh, maybe Barbara Wall.
Exactly. Next door to us was Leonard and Dorothy Rawl.
That's where they live.
And,
Barbara became, here is the story that I remember. She got the job at the Federal Reserve Research Department, And she came to me and she says, you know, I'm really scared. I said, why are you scared? She said, everybody in there is a Yale PhD. They know things. I said, yeah, you have to take a chance if you want to go there. She came to me after 6 or 12 months. She says, there hasn't been a thing that they knew that I didn't know.
Well, so that's a nice compliment to you.
Yeah, I thought so. Mm-hmm. And then she became Associate General Secretary of the Federal Reserve Board. Yeah, a big job. Mm-hmm. Now she's retired.
Right.
She was here with my other grad student, former grad student, for my retirement party.
That's what she told me.
Yeah.
She commented that. Right.
Yeah, she was here. She actually is the one who came to Carl and said that he wants for the grad students to have a lunch with him. The party was at night, you know, dinner. So we had a lunch, and it lasted a half a day, and then we went to the dinner here. So,
do you have any sense of the number of PhD or master's thesis students that you did supervise?
I had about 40 PhD students.
Wow. And did most of them end up doing things in international economics?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. All of them.
Okay.
That was the topic.
Well, I understand that's the topic, but maybe some did other things.
Yeah, so. A couple of them went to Wall Street, made a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
Well,
they send you monthly checks and thanks? Or?
They send the university.
Good.
They're not me.
Probably because of you. So.
No.
So you've been in touch with some of your students over the years,
sure.
Some of the 40.
Sure. We are actually organizing a big conference in Honolulu.
Oh.
One of them, I don't know, you want to talk about after my retirement or before my retirement?
Your choice, because we can come back another time and do something different, so. You choose.
He is Mike Plummer, with whom I wrote about, I don't know, 20, 30 papers.
Mike Plummer?
Plummer, yeah.
Okay, I don't know. 30 papers you wrote together?
Yeah.
Okay.
Papers, books, all kinds of
things. Right.
He is...
Is that a former student of yours? Or?
Yeah, former student. So he works for Johns Hopkins.
Okay.
He is the director of... the Johns Hopkins Graduate School for SICE, School of International and something events, SICE. You may be looking up somewhere.
In Baltimore, anyway.
Well, they have a big operation in Europe.
Oh.
And he's the director of their European operation in Italy.
So did you ever go over, or did you used to in the old days?
Yeah.
If you were working together that many papers, you must have...
Well, yeah, he was in several other places. He was teaching at Brandeis, he was teaching at...
Different places.
Different places, yeah.
He was a student of yours years ago.
Yeah.
30 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And, we were working together wherever he was. I was working together with other grad students, but probably that was the most. And I just got the message from him, organizing a conference in Honolulu.
And so you're going to go?
Yeah, health permitting. I have to add that. If I die beforehand, I'm not...
You won't go?
If I feel sick, I probably won't go. You know.
But you're still doing travel. We couldn't meet the last couple of weeks because you went to the U.S. Open.
Yeah, I travel some, not as much as I used to, much less.
So, I mentioned that. How did you get to be such a big tennis fan that you go to the U.S. Open?
I always all my life I played pickleball every day.
Here at MSU?
Here.
Along with other professors at lunch, yeah. Right?
And I played some tennis. Then I switched over after I had a hip replacement and the guy said you can't play pickleball anymore. I kind of switched to tennis.
Okay.
Now that my tennis days are winding down, I can still watch. So I go here when Michigan State plays, I go to a game that I am in town.
Okay. You're a big fan. You follow it.
It's the only game I watch.
Okay. Interesting choice. Who are the other... So I came at 77, and I got to know some of the people who would hang out at the IM West to do different things. Who did you play paddleball with?
Well, I don't know if you know them. Lon McGilliam?
No.
All these guys from physical education.
Okay. See, I thought Lash was over there sometimes to play paddleball,
but he was
not a serious player.
No, he was not a serious player.
He was having more fun with cocoa butter tanning contests.
And anyway, I guess so.
Different silly things.
Yeah.
But he did do that
he
at lunch
play.
Some.
Yeah.
Bob Ripas, who was a good friend of mine, he was a swimmer and a volleyball player.
What happened to him and his wife? I think Elida told me she was a very close friend of his wife.
So
I didn't know what happened to them.
Well, Bob passed away maybe 15 years ago. He had a variety of problems. He had been diabetic. And because I remember that, because when we would go swimming, he had to eat before we went swimming. And that always seemed funny to me, but that's how we did it. Mm-hmm. Except one day a week he played volleyball with other professors and staff. But he retired in like 84, and I'd say he lived to maybe another 10 years, but he had a couple different kinds of cancer and different problems. Babs Ripas had some issues that she used to go to Mayo for, but she's still alive, but under care of her daughter. She lives still in the house in Bath that they built.
Oh, really?
And they moved there around, say, 90.
Sometime. So you see them sometime?
I had been seeing Babs, but the last year or so, her daughter-in-law has suggested it's not going to work, so I haven't tried. But I had been seeing Bamps. I've been visiting Bob and then Bamps for a while. But I was quite close to Bob Ripas. But anyways, we would see Walter over there. I don't know what Walter did.
Not serious, but he played a little
paddleball. Little paddleball, okay. And there were a lot of other people that were swimmers. There were a lot of faculty that were swimmers.
Well, a lot of you was a swimmer.
Right.
But I swam some, but I didn't particularly enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
I liked paddleball.
Well, I understand.
Lou Heckeis, the other meeting,
okay.
He was my partner.
Okay.
I got him all,
I see these trophies.
I got
here.
Him all these trophies. He says, I got you all these trophies. Well, he's left-handed, so that helps.
Oh, very good. I remember, so Leonard Brault did some international things.
He went on an MSU project in Brazil and an MSU project in Turkey.
And he was our next-door neighbor. His wife, Dorothy, who had been a school teacher.
Yeah, in the high school, yeah.
Right, was still a good tennis player in her 80s. Because I remember playing with her in the park, just lobbing it around. But it was fun to see someone who was older who was could put such good spins. I found that there were a number of seniors that knew how to spin the tennis ball so that the younger person was in trouble like me.
Well,
is that how you played?
I played.
Yeah.
I'm going to play tomorrow.
Do you do that at the MAC or at the university?
At the university.
Okay.
And what I do at the MAC is water aerobics.
Water aerobics, okay.
Right.
I wondered what you did there because I only see you in the locker room.
In my 9 o'clock class, I go to water aerobics.
Okay.
And sometimes I play tennis. On Sunday, I go bowling. the Bnei Brith Bowling League.
What do you call it?
The Bnei Brith Bowling League.
Okay. And I just knew it was the Hebrew Bowling League because Rich Block said I would have to convert if I wanted to play.
No, actually, that's not true.
Well, I know it is. I've played a couple times as a sub.
I am a sub.
Okay.
But Rich Block plays, yeah.
Howard Heidelman I know well, and Howard's...
Oh, yeah, Howard plays.
Yeah. So many of these are guys that from KI, or the ones I know mostly, yeah. KI folks.
Yeah, well...
But
a lot of them are from Shari Tzedek too.
Right.
So I do tennis, water aerobics, and bowling, which are physical.
Mm-hmm.
Then I do Bible studies.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, we have a class, right now we are doing the New Testament.
Where do you do that? With what
in
room?
In the synagogue. Well, I started that long time ago when Rabbi Hoffman was alive. But he didn't like to teach the New Testament because he said, I can't go on teaching something I don't know much about.
Uh-huh.
Then he died, and we didn't know what to do. So I had an idea. Fred Greer. Do you know him?
A little.
I called him up. I said, Fred, I remember when you retired, you told me what I'm not going to know what to do. I said, I got a solution. You come to us. So he guides the class. He's my resource person.
So how many people attend this?
About 10.
Wow. Like once a month or?
No, every week.
Once a week?
Yeah, once a week.
Oh.
We're now doing the Book of Acts. Do you know what
it's for?
Do you know the New Testament?
Yes, somewhat.
Acts. It's after the fall, after John.
Right.
It's Acts.
And then, Acts. Acts of the Apostles.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I want to do Paul's letters.
Okay.
So we'll do all that.
Okay.
We finish the fall.
Gotcha. Okay.
And... what else? I play bridge a lot.
I was going to ask you, because a lot of people of your generation were bridge players.
Well, I'm not the bridge player of my generation.
No? You learned more recent?
Yeah.
Oh. So you and your wife weren't one of these couples that played bridge?
No, my wife, I don't want to mention that. She has Parkinson's, she can't move.
Mm-hmm.
She also has, how do you call it, forgetfulness?
Well, Alzheimer's, dementia.
Dementia.
Uh-huh.
Along with Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, but she didn't always have it. You could have, my point
no,
was.
No, we never played bridge together.
My point is people in the 50s, 60s.
No, I started.
There were a lot of people playing bridge.
More recently.
Oh, very good.
Then.
Do you do crossword puzzles and?
Well, I don't do crossword puzzles, but I do a couple of other things. I developed a way of teaching a language through songs.
Hmm.
And I teach Hebrew through songs.
At Temple? I mean, through the...
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to expand it into Detroit, but I don't know yet.
Into Detroit?
Yeah, into a bigger market.
Southfield and our Bloomfield Hills, the center of the Jewish community.
Are you from Detroit?
Yeah, I was born in Detroit and raised in Oakland County. I went to Birmingham High School.
Yeah, the largest synagogue in America is the, what's it called, Beit Israel or something.
Mm-hmm.
Got 3,500 families. I'll see if that's successful.
So it teaching Hebrew via songs?
By songs, yeah.
Songs from the Old Testament, or?
So new Israeli songs, old songs, new songs. And they don't have to know the alphabet. We do everything by translation and transliteration.
Hmm.
And it takes the drudgery of learning a language. It's kind of simple.
What age are you teaching?
I have 5 to 8 adults and 2 children in the class. And then...
Are they all people who aren't Jewish, or are they...
No, they're Jewish.
They're all... Okay.
Well...
But not Hebrew speakers.
No, 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 they don't know Hebrew.
Okay. Would you consider someone like Rich somebody who's a Hebrew speaker, or...
No.
Okay.
He knows a little Hebrew.
Yeah, right, but he knows enough for going to services.
His bar mitzvah, he probably remembers.
What about, so, you know, I was,
but no, I wouldn't consider him a Hebrew speaker.
Okay, but, so, you know, I was FGO for 8 years.
Yeah, you told me.
And before me was Mike Rubner, and Rubner was definitely a Hebrew speaker.
Well, Rubner was half Israeli.
Right. And,
he wouldn't need my class.
Okay. But he might get a laugh. He might think it was funny.
Yeah, I think it is kind of funny.
I mean, in a positive way, he would be amused. So.
Well, it's a.
Because it's a
new way.
It sounds like a wonderful idea. I'm complimenting you.
It's a new way. I don't know. And then I started writing a column. I thought I had this magazine here. Called Lansing Business Magazine.
I know the magazine.
Oh, you know?
But no, I don't know what you're referring to, but I know the
magazine. Well, I started last month writing a column.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
Well,
you can show me next time.
Well, I tell you right now where the... If you see the magazine of last month, that's when I started.
Were you going to be a regular columnist?
Well, right now I'm every month, you know.
Wow.
What the hell?
An international...
Page 26.
Okay.
What I'm trying to explain economic policy without math. No graphs, no equations,
okay.
No calculus, straight words.
Are you one of the only economists who can do that?
I don't know about the only, but not many.
But it's rare now,
yeah,
right?
Right. And so this, everybody who graduated high school should be able to understand.
Good.
I mean, just if he knows English.
Uh-huh. Very good idea.
So,
who came up with that idea?
Me. So, Lansing, in the August issue, it's on page 26.
Okay.
And in the September issue, it just came out.
Well, I can find
it. It's upstairs. I'm having the office.
Make a copy.
Make copies. Of
so, it's the Lansing Business Magazine?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, and then I already turned in 2 or 3 more months, you know, the
Great.
Period. So and what I'm doing, to make it interesting, I'm using a U.S.-Europe comparison.
A what comparison?
U.S.-Europe.
Okay, U.S. and Europe, that was your comparison. Okay.
Yeah, because we came out of the recession much faster than they did. And we're doing much better. So I use it to explain why that is.
So I will find out when I read it why you believe that that's the case.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not what I believe, it's what the statistics say.
Well.
So anyway,
Do you think everybody would agree with you?
Not on everything.
Okay.
But that we are doing better than Europe, yeah.
Right.
Everybody would agree with that. Yeah.
But the reasons why?
Europe, that's right. But remember, I mean, we have 5.5% unemployment. Europe has 11%.
Do we count it the same way? Close enough?
Close enough.
Close enough that you think it's reliable.
So, yeah, close enough. Okay. And also remember, we are talking about changes over years in each place.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't change the way we count, and they didn't change. They have a serious unemployment problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about it. And we know exactly why we do better than them. So I explain it in those, in the The third one that will come, we're now in September, so the October one, well, the first one simply laid out the issues. Mm-hmm. The second one, it was kind of an explanation of the European setup.
Okay.
And then the third
one... It's the EU, you mean?
Yeah, the EU and the euro.
Okay.
The primer.
Okay.
And then I do... There is one... After that will be... what do you do in a recession?
Okay.
Fiscal policy. And then... one on the budget deficits and the national debt.
Wow. You've got a whole series laid out.
A whole series.
So do you have an editor?
No, I just said it.
Well, there's an editor at the magazine.
I know, but they didn't change anything.
Really? Okay.
Oh, okay.
Maybe he doesn't understand, but...
No, no, he understands, but I think I know English better,
well,
better than the editor.
I'm not doubting it, but... If there were an editor that was engaged, if I were the editor, let me put it that way, I might say, could you explain what's happening in China?
Okay, let me explain something. If this was a daily paper, and this was a weekly column, then when we just went through those gyrations in the foreign currency market, mm-hmm. I will have a column on that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, it's once a month.
Okay.
By the time I will come to explain that, people will have forgotten.
Okay.
So I will pursue this, and then I'll do monetary policy.
Okay.
And then I'll do some international, both both trade and finance. For another example is, there was a big issue in the Congress about the Pacific agreement, the Trans-Pacific
mm-hmm.
agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if this was a weekly column, I would have explained it. The way it's set up, I will explain all the macro stuff, and then I will do the international, all verbally. Just words. Yeah, you see, there is nothing.
Because you said no graphs, no charts.
You see, there is nothing here but words.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a column. And eventually I might publish it as a book.
I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
I would assume so.
I don't know. Yeah.
Kind of, for it's kind of like for layman, for...
For anybody who is interested in this,
with at least a high school American level
English.
Of
it
English.
English.
Mm-hmm.
And it
would Europeans enjoy it, or
if they know English?
Most do, don't they?
Well, it depends on the country.
Okay.
Swedes do.
British do. Irish do.
The British do. Yeah.
Most French.
I just simply.
Most Germans.
I don't know. You know, I just started thinking about these things when I retired. I said, well, you know, I know Hebrew, I know how to sing, and what else does it take? Combine those three, and you teach Hebrew by singing, and I know how to teach,
mm-hmm.
well, after all these years. So I thought, if I know how to teach, I know how to sing, and I know Hebrew, I can teach Hebrew by songs.
So that is the theme of what you've said in Bible studies.
No, it's got nothing to do with Bible studies.
Okay,
no.
But teaching Hebrew in songs, and this column for the business magazine.
That's new.
But they're examples of you doing teaching as a retiree.
Yeah, you might say that, yeah. But they are new. The Bible studies has been going on for 10 years.
Okay.
Those are two new things that I thought of since I retired.
The teaching Hebrew and the
the
in
teaching
column.
Hebrew by songs and write a column for a magazine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Had you wondered when you were trying to decide whether or not to retire, what am I going to do when I grow up?
Not really. I retired because I was sick.
Okay.
I probably wouldn't have retired otherwise.
Okay.
And so I didn't think I could any longer handle the discipline of a class.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided it's the time to retire.
I forget what
I was.
You were teaching large 85. Lecture class at the time?
At the time I was teaching those large lecture classes, yeah.
You weren't doing any grading or anything like that, correct?
No, I had about 10 TAs.
10 TAs.
It takes a lot of energy to manage the TAs.
Mm-hmm.
And so, listen, I got to run upstairs to go to the bathroom.
I wouldn't mind that we schedule another time. This was a good place to stop. And I come back next week or something?
Well, I don't know. We seem to be having trouble scheduling.
We won't. We'll be okay.
It's okay by me.
Yeah.
What time is it? It's a little after.
We've been going about 40 minutes. Much of the scheduling problems have been my difficulty because I had some health problems. So.
Don't we all?
So, one possibility would be next Tuesday, but it doesn't have to be.
Let me. Next Tuesday would be the 29th.
But if that's not good, I can give you another date. Is that good?
No, Tuesday is okay.
Okay.
But I have a luncheon.
Well,
so what time?
You want to make it 2 o'clock?
Make it
2:30?
No, 1:30.
1:30?
Here.
Here. Yeah, of course here.
1:30. Interview. The lunch would be at 11:45.
If you want to make it a little later, just let me know.
No, it's fine.
But can I tell you some other things I'd like to talk to you about so you can think about it?
Sure.
So I'm very intrigued since I just
let me tell you what I thought you were going to talk about.
Okay, then that might be on my list. Go ahead.
People ask. They ask me too. What do you do when you retire?
Uh huh.
Well, I had those 5 activities that I was pursuing from before.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a lot of time, but it doesn't take all your time.
Right.
Plus, of course, seeing doctors. I don't have to add that.
Right.
And so then I came up with those 2 activities.
Mm-hmm.
One is teaching Hebrew for songs.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is writing a column on economics.
Are you a singer, by the way?
I sing. What do you mean? I'm a professional singer.
No. But some people could teach through song but play music and not sing themselves.
No,
Or just use the words.
I do sing, yeah.
Okay.
I do sing.
Okay.
Actually, I think I'm a pretty good singer.
Okay.
Did you sing
in synagogue?
No.
Were you ever a cantor?
What?
Were you ever a cantor?
No.
Well, you could have been.
I could have been, but I was.
But you weren't. Okay. So one thing I remember about...
So that's what I thought you were going to talk about what happened to you after you retired.
Well, that does interest me because I just retired a year or so ago.
Well, you have to have things to do.
Right, and so I've been doing some...
You know, interview people.
I interview people and I'm writing some papers and I'll share some with you if you're interested. But,
yeah.
Did you know Rebus very well? You said you met.
Well, I knew him, but it's been a while, yeah.
So, I bring it. I might not have brought it, but I'll bring it another time.
Did you tell me?
Bob had a fight with you. You know, his job was same as what I was originally hired to do, which was the School of Labor Relations, we used to have a very large outreach project.
Yeah.
And so when Killingsworth started the school and Jack was hired to run research, there was a guy, Fred Haler, who was in charge of the outreach for unions.
Yeah.
And so that's what REPAS did, and that's what I was originally hired to do, was outreach to unions. And REPAS ended up in an unfortunate dispute with the UAW, which boycotted his classes because he drove Babs's car to union halls, and it was a foreign car.
Was there a telephone ring when I was
there? I didn't hear it.
Weird.
I didn't hear it. In addition, Bob also supported, you may remember Zoltan Ferency.
Of course, well.
Okay, he's another person I'd like to talk to you about again another time.
Oh, yeah.
But so I knew Zeef somewhat. Bob was very close to Zoltan. And during one of Zoltan's attempts at winning an election, he was a candidate for the governor of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I vaguely remember.
And the UAW was in favor of Blanchard, who had just helped work on the deal with Saving Chrysler, Lee Iacocca, all that. So Bob got in trouble for several things, and they boycotted his classes. And he ended up filing a grievance against Stieber and Brickner for not defending his academic freedom. So I wrote a paper about that, but it got to revise and resubmit because I need to do some more about it. The journal I submitted to wanted more about academic freedom to frame it, not just the story. But but I'm also working on some things about the history of the grievance procedure, so I wanted to ask you if you had any interactions with the grievance procedure.
I know, when Carolyn was an ombudsman, I actually reversed the process. I used to supply her with work. A student comes and says, well, I didn't make the deadline of submitting the homework.
Uh-huh.
And I started giving you a long story. And I didn't have patience for that. I said, you go to the ombudsman. If you can convince them, that's good enough for me.
Okay,
so
very good.
I used to reverse the process.
So just like you're doing some economics, I wanted to ask you about some economic things I don't know much about, but I was curious about your opinions about Piketty, for example.
Who?
Thomas Piketty. I'm just mispronouncing his name. You're not familiar with his writing? Oh, I'm surprised. I can leave that with you.
Yeah. He's not that Frenchman.
Yeah.
Oh, he's the Frenchman who wrote that book.
Right.
Yeah, I know who he is. I don't have an opinion on it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know enough about it, but yeah, very famous.
Okay, yeah, big stir recently.
Yeah.
I was curious in terms of the labor relations world that I know, if in any of your work on international, so like you were saying you wanted to explain Europe, Europe's still more unionized than
of
the
course,
United States.
Of course, I'm just doing it the macro side. The micro side with regulations and labor relations and all that, I might get to some point, but right now I'm just doing the micro thing.
But I assume you have some opinions about that and how that relates, and so I wanted to ask you a bit about that.
Mm.
I think when we chatted at the
MAC,
I might have asked you if you would say anything about different presidents or provosts that you worked with and sort of how MSU evolved over the years. Different people have different opinions about that. If you don't want it on tape, I'll turn the tape off. But
I don't want it on tape.
Okay. But you might.
I do have opinion. I mean.
Right.
Remember, in the 80s, I was very involved.
So, involved in academic governance kinds of things.
Well, I was chairman of the basically the academic
council.
Okay. So,
and the steering committee.
And some of that you'd be willing to talk and take,
yeah,
and some
but,
not.
But I, in the 80s, I was very involved.
Well,
yeah,
so
I developed this plan. You know, they wanted to fire 200 faculty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. You weren't here at the time?
What year?
In the 80s, early 80s.
Well, if you're talking about Cecil Mackey's years,
yeah.
Yes, I was here.
Well, he and his provost, is this on?
Yeah, but I can turn it off. I can put it on pause.
That there shouldn't be a union.
So during the 70s,
in the 80s, yeah,
and
involved.
Early 80s, there were three times to unionize, and
right.
The one we're talking about is the one in the 80s, and you opposed it.
I opposed it.
Why did you think it was
because
a bad idea?
Because a union is very good for standardized kind of stuff,
uh-huh.
Not for a university where everybody is a specialist in something.
Uh-huh.
And so, and everybody has a national market in his specialty, and his pay should depend on the national market and its specialty, and rather than standardize things. I thought that was a very bad idea.
So I was fairly involved in the third unionization attempt, and one of the things I could tell you, which fits in, I think, to the story you're saying,
yeah,
is the people that were most interested in the union were the ones that weren't what you were just describing. They were people who were mostly teachers. That is, they were the people in the basic NAT side, the basic humanities, the basic social science, who primarily were teachers and not as much researchers and scholars. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it's probably fair. I mean, either the university gets unionized or not.
Mm-hmm.
You can't unionize half the university. And I just didn't think unions are a good thing for a university,
mm-hmm.
basically. I mean, this is not UAW here.
My sense at the time following up was that the people who were part of the MEA, which was called Faculty Associates, MEA sponsored, would fit in what I was saying. There were others that were AAUP, and the AAUP folks were probably closer to your point, but some, I think, could be characterized as saying, we're not really in favor of union, but if there's going to be one, it ought to be AAUP because it's more about
it's
professors.
Probably true, yeah. I'll tell you kind of an interesting side story. After the 80s, what I did here was published all over the country,
mm-hmm.
including the AAUP journal or whatever it's called.
Right.
And so I went to about 10 universities that you could
put
on, you know, 10 universities that were in financial trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They would call the AAUP, and the AAUP would call me, and I would go to help where I could.
Mm-hmm. About the value of academic governance and what you did,
yeah,
in terms of defending tenure.
You can
tape this.
Tape it.
Yeah, I am right now. I just turned on.
And one story is stuck in my mind, and you'll see why. It was a university in the Northwest.
Okay.
And I came there, the AUP called me and said that they are having a big trouble. I go there. I met the AUP governance board,
mm-hmm.
and they told me that 100 dismissal notices had been sent.
Wow.
To faculty members, and there was a big tumult on the campus. Could I help in any way? I said, well, let me see the president. So I went and saw the president. He was a biblical scholar.
Oh.
That helped me an awful lot.
Uh-huh.
I had a rapport with him. So I said to him, you know, it is not cost-free to lay off faculty.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be able to attract new faculty. You're going to get a big black eye in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So he says to me, what can I do? I don't have money for buyouts. That's what we did at Michigan State.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I just don't have money for buyouts.
Mm-hmm.
What am I going to do? I said to him, well, let me look at your budget.
he gave me an office, and I sat down, looked at his budget. He had a 9.5% shortfall.
Hmm?
A 9.5% shortfall on the budget.
Hmm?
And had no money to do anything. So we met again, and he said, well, what do you think? I said to him, do you have a sabbatical program here? He says, yeah, on the books, but nobody has ever taken a sabbatical.
No one. Is this a small little college, or?
Well, about 20,000.
So it's not the size of Eastern or Western?
Yeah, yeah, one of those.
Yeah.
So I said to him, well, we're going to change that now. From now on, for the next 7 years, and you know, seven is the most important number in the Bible.
Uh-huh.
So you're number seven. So everybody has come up to a sabbatical, will take a year sabbatical at half the salary. That will save you 7.5% of your budget.
Mm-hmm.
Another percent you take out of supplies and services,
right,
whatever. When that came out, there was a lot of tumult on the campus.
Mm.
First of all, the Blue Ribbon Committee that recommended the firing of 100 faculty,
right,
that was in a bad way everywhere, everybody hated them,
mm-hmm,
said, well, now we wouldn't even get what we recommended.
Right.
Secondly, a lot of people were not at risk. Why should we take a sabbatical if we are not at risk? The students, well, you know how students are.
Mm.
Suddenly, we'll have fewer professors to mm-hmm teach us. God forbid.
Right.
And, of course, there were a lot of pause. So he says to me, I scheduled a meeting for tomorrow morning of representatives of all the constituents of the university, a breakfast. You present your plan there and we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I came there, after breakfast, I made my speech, and then opened it up to questions. It started with questions, then criticisms, then developed into arguments against it, attacks. I could see that I am not making a sale. I said to them, you know, if you don't like it, I do have a day job. I didn't get a dismissal notice. I'll get on the plane and meet my class. At that point, a little fellow who sat in the corner and didn't say a word gets up and he says, no, I like it. You should have seen the change in that room.
Who was that man?
Well, I didn't know at the time.
Right.
Everybody suddenly
listened to him.
Not only listened, it was the second coming. This proposal, they never heard of such a wonderful solution.
Uh-huh.
So I said to the president, who's this guy? He says, well, he's the chairman of the board.
Oh, okay.
And he
of trustees or whatever.
Of trustees.
Okay.
And he's the largest employer in town.
Oh.
And he says, I think, and that's something that what faculty loves to hear. I think it's good for faculty to get some outside experience. And those people who have to go on half salary with sabbatical, I'm going to try and fill them up for them. And then I left. I met this guy 2 years later in Detroit.
The employer guy?
The guy who was the head of the chairman of the board.
Right, right.
He Detroit had at the time a national convention of boards of trustees.
Of what?
Boards of trustees, there is such thing.
Okay.
So I came, and they asked me to give a talk, so I went there and I met him.
Okay.
He says to me, the plan worked out like as smooth as can be.
Huh.
And we were you can see why this story is what I remember out of about 10.
Do you think this is Oregon or Washington?
Yeah, it's one of those. Okay. I don't want to identify.
No, I don't. That's fine. But Northwest, you switched.
Yeah, the Northwest of the United
Not
States.
Not likely Idaho. So, very cool.
It just happened.
So, can I ask you to sign the release form?
I know. Releasing what?
Well, we can make a copy for you, but eventually I'll donate this to the archives, to the Voice Library. So, I interviewed Lash LaRue, and his interview actually you could listen to online. I did it 15 years ago or something. Partly it was on because he was grievance official, and I wanted to record his experiences as grievance official.
I know a little bit about it, actually.
Partly it was because, of course, he was a labor historian. Not everybody knew, but he wrote a couple of important labor history books, including his big biography on Harry Bridges. On the
I know all about it.
Oh, you do? Why do you know all about that?
I don't know why. We were here in the same offices. I know a lot.
When he was writing it, okay.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I met somebody in San Francisco who knew about it.
Okay.
And asked me, do you know Lash LaRue? Not Lash.
Charles.
I says, yeah, I know Charles LaRue. I read his book.
It's a good biography. It's well done.
You know, but I knew about it when he was working on it. And he was very close to Adams.
Right. Where were your offices then?
Well, we started out when I came here, there was this small hall there.
What one?
Morrill Hall, a big
building. Oh, Morrill, right, of course, yeah.
Well, they gave us a floor in that office.
Okay.
And I shared office with two others. One was LaRue, and the other was this Malonix, another labor economist.
Okay.
And LaRue had a lot of patience.
You had three in a room?
Yeah.
Wow.
The dean at the time, whoever, McQuiggie guy, I think, psychologist, used to love to write memos with a circular note who should get them.
Okay.
So
okay.
I would get a memo. I didn't have patience to read it. I put it on LaRue's desk. So LaRue, oh, that's an interesting memo, he says to me. I said, what does it say? He tells me what it says. Then he looks at the circulation and says, I'm not even on this list. I said, well, at least you know now. Let me just see who this might be.
Oh, go right ahead. We can stop anyways. I'll turn this off.
I didn't get here until 1.
So anyways, you were roommates with LaRue for a while. Back when you were at Morrill Hall.
In Morrill Hall, we had a whole floor.
Third floor?
I don't remember.
Okay, it doesn't matter.
We all had two roommates, two office mates.
Okay.
And for quite a few years, actually, I can't remember how long it was, but...
And then moved over here?
Yeah, then we moved over here, we got our own offices, but this was not the way the building
was. Oh, it's been very gorgeous.
It was an old building.
Right, I remember.
Yeah, but we got our own offices.
Yeah.
No, I was upstairs on the first floor, and LaRue was on the, not LaRue.
And?
Walter was on the first floor.
Yeah, I know where Walter's office was.
Well, when I was around the corner. And... we lived that way for quite a few years until we got this palace.
Yeah, not the...
And I lost my office. I had a big office upstairs.
Right. But this is a nice office.
I'm happy.
Yeah, not every department still has retiring offices.
It's really an unusual situation.
What's the unusual?
I needed an elevator. Otherwise, they would have put me next door.
Okay.
So... but only this building has an elevator, and so Carl arranged it for me.
Well, I like this, a nice office.
and I use it. I mean, a lot of people what's his name? The guy who plays bowling that you mentioned.
Block?
Block, Rich Block says. I was talking to Menchik about it, bowling. So Rich Block says, you know, I've been retired for 3 years. I have an office in one of those halls.
Ketzi.
And you know how many times I've been there?
Zero.
Zero. So don't worry about it. The difference is that I do use the office.
Mm. Yeah, well, I have a study, Carol, at the library.
That's not bad, actually.
No, it's not bad. It's okay.
But I am happy.
Good. Yeah. Well, I'm glad that we got together, and we'll get together next week.
Okay.